Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
So, Apple's in court.
Do we need like special theme music for that? I feel like dun dun, like Law and Order, or
one more outburst, and I'll clear this courtroom. Order, order.
In my head, I think the theme song playing was actually the Night Court theme song.
Oh, wow, that would be different. Judge Harry Stone presiding in the case of Apple versus Epic.
I mean, I don't know. If they had John Larroquette as one of their lawyers, I'm not sure how that would go, but
probably not well.
Probably not well.
I wrote a thing. I know this is insider baseball stuff, but I woke up this morning to see that Mark Gurman wrote like four paragraphs in a Bloomberg newsletter about the Apple case and got on TechMeme, and he's literally writing the same subject that I wrote my Macworld column about this week, where I slaughtered, you know, 1,000 words on the same subject. And I was like, come on, folks. My piece is basically on the exact same subject and way more in depth. I mean, I wouldn't say better, because I'm not going to judge that, but like, I did a lot more work than Mark did. But, you know, he's
short,
Mark Gurman.
Short and pithy. Short and pithy.
It is true. Also, I didn't submit mine to TechMeme, so that's probably on me. But that was a piece that I wrote at the airport. I haven't written an article sitting at an airport gate in a long time, because I've been at an airport gate in a long time.
Throwback Friday.
Yeah. But it was just me throwing out all my wacky ideas, some of which we talked about here last week about Apple. Basically, like, Apple's going to win this case almost certainly, but they're probably going to have to still do stuff to throw people off the scent, right? So that was just, I was just trying to go in through all of that, because it does feel like they're going to do that, because what we said last week, that Tim Cook's like, yeah, we're moving, we're shaking, we're moving with the times, we're not set in concrete.
Do you think, cool. You know, I realize, and this may come as a shock to our listeners, but I realize that neither of us are lawyers.
Not anymore. Not since that incident.
When we
were both disbarred.
Yeah. That was being kicked out of a bar, though. That was for something totally different.
Right. We said we were lawyers, and they said that's a lie, and they kicked us out of the bar.
We don't serve your kind here.
These are the jokes, folks.
And I was just like, I can't. It's harder for me to tell from a legal perspective the possible pitfalls that Apple has in terms of its case. Like, I just don't, I don't know enough of the specifics of the law to say, like, it seems, oh yeah, this seems like, you know, open and shut, Apple's going to win it. It does seem like the evidence, like the stuff that's come out so far, seems to tilt in their favor. Although I have seen people make the opposite argument, and I'm like, all right, I'm just taking away a very different thing from this evidence than you are. I don't know. But I mean, you seem confident that you feel like Apple is going to win this. Is there something that gives you that confidence, having seen the kind of stuff that's come out?
I don't think that Epic is making a case, a good case, that Apple has violated the law here. Mm-hmm. To me, that's pretty much it. It's like Epic, the burden is on Epic here, and I don't think that they've done it. I think that Apple, this whole thing has seemed, I mean, first off, the judge always has been very skeptical of Epic. Again, not a lawyer, but skeptical of Epic. Epic, this is a calculated incident created by Epic in order for them to sue Apple. And that, I think, increases the burden that they have to show that, well, no, actually, this is all just precipitated by all this. This strikes me, and again, I am a layperson, although I am also reading more highfalutin analysis of it, that this is essentially an exercise to get Apple's dirty laundry out in public. And emails and memos and Apple's own words in order to make Apple bleed. Like, that's really the goal here is, I mean, I'm sure Epic would love to win, but I think that that's not really the game Epic is playing. Epic is playing a game that they want to wound Apple, and they want to make it harder for Apple to pretend that it's, you know, what it's doing is fine. I think their feeling is that the more people understand what Apple's policies actually are, the more people will say, that doesn't seem right to me. And that hurts, that hurts Apple, and it hurts Apple's reputation. And some of us who've been watching closely have known, you know, all the vagaries of App Review and things like that for more than a decade now. But a lot of people don't understand. Like, there was that moment where, was this in the, I forget what it was. Was it one of the Senate things where it's like, what do you mean you can't link to your website from within the app? And it's like, yeah, that's not allowed. Like, that's crazy.
Right,
it's like,
right.
Well, yeah, but we went through this in 2010, right? Like, we've been, that's old news, folks.
Right, right. Or the subscriptions. Yeah. I feel like I kind of agree with you. And I feel like the sense for me is like, Epic is out to prove that Apple is a jerk, basically. And
yeah.
It's like, yeah, you've kind of done that. But being a jerk is sadly not against the law. So yeah, I agree with you that it feels much more calculated to tarnish their image, and that may be working. I won't say flabbergasted is too strong, but like, I kind of roll my eyes a bit just thinking like, this is not a cheap exercise
no.
to go this far. And it's not that Epic doesn't have plenty of money. They've made right. Billions of dollars off Fortnite so far, but it is still, it feels vendetta like in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it is. And I think also you could argue that Epic is thinking that the amount of money that they're spending on this, there's a decent chance it will ultimately come back in some adaptation to Apple's policies. That like, if you get this right and you have the ability to do something that will boost the amount of money you make, either because Apple is taking less of a cut or Apple is letting you link to your store on the web or Apple mm-hmm. is allowing you to do in-app purchase, which is, you know, what their dream is, that is controlled by them. But regardless, I think that's the strategy, is make this so annoying and so bad for Apple that Apple ends up being in a position. Because remember, you know, it's not just this, it's the EU and it's the Spotify yep. thing. And like, yep. it's all of those, it's a, like a pincer movement of like, we're going to squeeze these guys, we're going to put their back up against the wall, and whatever shakes out is probably going to be good for us as Epic, because they're going to have to give somewhere. Which is funny, because the one place where they've given so far that Tim Cook talked about is the program that's carefully calibrated not to give any money to Epic.
Yeah. I really look forward to the refinement of that program, where it's like, we will cut you, you know, 15% profits unless your name rhymes with Schmepic.
Yeah,
like,
it's you know, games with in-app purchases are not covered, but everything else is.
Right.
Like, oh,
right. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's fascinating, and the, I will say, just from a journalistic perspective, the discovery has been really interesting, because a lot of it confirms, I think, stuff that we had either inferred or stuff that we had heard whispers about but never had like evidence to back up. So, for example, there was a great email that came out this week about Phil Schiller basically astounded that some knockoff game had reached the top charts in the App Store, and being like, what is going on here? And I think, you know, position, like, looking at the timing of that, you kind of get the idea, like, this is Phil kind of at the point where he decided to take stuff over, I think, and sort of crack down more on the App Store stuff, and that becoming his responsibility rather than Eddie Q's. So, I mean, stuff that you could kind of tell was like, this was a problem. And fascinating, too, from the perspective of, you know, clearly we all understand that they're aware of all these problems. You know, I think that the scams and the copycat apps and all this stuff. And I think, as we've all concluded, part of this is just that it's a lot harder problem to solve than most people think. And so the fact that like Phil Schiller can be like, ah, this is terrible, how did this get to the top of the store? We need to like clamp down on this. And then that was like 6 or 7 years ago. And it's like, well, you've maybe solved that problem, but there's still plenty of other problems with scams in the App Store. And maybe you're realizing that that was not a snap your fingers and fix it sort of issue so much as your volume and the problems you're dealing with are really difficult to deal with at the scale that you're at.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's interesting to see some of this stuff come to light when they talk about that, or like, you know, people going off on Twitter. I saw about like the there was another bit this week about Hulu having access to private APIs for canceling subscriptions because they were kind of on like a whitelist of apps that had access to it. And a lot of the developers I saw were like, you know, the kind of taking to task Apple's stated argument of we treat everybody the same.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, realizing at that point, like, we all knew that they didn't treat everybody the same, right? Like, all of us are aware of the fact that there is, if you get to a point where you are a gigantic corporation, you are going to have access, at least, if nothing else, to higher echelons of Apple's management that are going to be able to, you know, get things done for you that they can't necessarily get done for a indie app developer. We all knew
Everybody always assumes that. The problem is Apple saying, oh, no, we treat everybody the same.
Exactly.
Because because that allows them to hide behind the, look, we don't make the rules, we just enforce them, but also we make the rules approach that they've had all along. In public, right? We see with these emails now that, like, it is exactly what we thought it was, which is they're all talking about this stuff behind the scenes. But from to the outside, they have had this projection of, like, well, look, you know, we just have it's just a black box and it runs itself and it's got the rules in it and that's just how it is and they're there for a reason. And that is part of the purpose of this whole process, is to crack that and say, no, this is more arbitrary and capricious, and they're conspiring in order to maximize their revenue and take money away from the people who are doing this. And this is, you know, but again, I mean, not to rehash this was all discussed last year when this first came out, but, like, the fact that they spend a lot of time arguing about, like, who takes 30%, and the answer is lots of people take 30%. And it gets to be a very weird case where basically the judge would have to go sort of against what the law has generally been interpreted to mean, and make a real change that would have wide-ranging impact, which is why, you know, the appeals, assuming Epic loses, the appeals could be very interesting here, because what Epic really wants is a court ruling that basically says that nobody should be able to set 30%. And I wonder what the standing in the law can be for mandating somebody's profit margin on a product, or somebody's, like, how do you do that if there are a bunch of different stores that are all offering this and they're all run by regular old companies, corporations, right? Like, why?
Right. Yeah, right.
It's a very hard, 'cause then you get into the Xbox thing, and one of their arguments that I find to be the most bizarre, and again, not a lawyer here, but, like, childlike argument, is their argument that, well, yeah, Xbox and PlayStation take 30%, but they subsidize their consoles. They don't make as much money on their consoles, and they have to make up the money using, and they use that tone of voice, by the way. They have to make it up because they aren't making a profit on the hardware, where Apple makes a profit on the hardware and they want 30%. It's just not fair. And it's like, I think that is the worst argument, because that argument is basically like, your profit margin on hardware determines, like, there's a limited number of profits that you're allowed to have. And if it's in the hardware, it can't be in the software, the add-on sales. But if it's in the add-on sales, it can't be in the hardware. Like, it doesn't follow. I get that's why it is the way it is. But their argument is really like, well, yeah, they do it, but they're not doing it to be greedy, like Apple, which is greedy and they're bad. And it's like, I don't think that's a very good argument. Like,
again, that's the argument that it's a business. Like, it's not an argument. I mean, and I found that the similar argument with the iMessage thing with the lock-in, where it's like, oh, they know it's hard to leave iMessage. And it's like, well, yeah, it's not their job to make it easy to leave their platform. That's not the rule. The rule is not you must do work to make it easy for somebody to leave your device and go to somebody else's device.
And I feel like in general, what's going to get Apple is anti-competitive behavior and greedy, skimming 30% off, rent-seeking kind of stuff. It makes Apple look bad, and I think it is bad in a lot of ways, but that's not the part that's anti-competitive, right? Like, the anti-competitive stuff is, it's a tougher road for Epic than for Spotify, for example. And I think that's where Apple, right? Because it's like, who are we to say how much a private company charges? If people will spend the money, then who are we to stop them, right? Like, it's the market, and it's a free market, and this is a company and all that. It's different if they're like, oh, but they've rigged the game so that nobody can compete with them.
Yeah, right. I mean, and this goes back to the, there's a lot of hand-wringing over the DOJ ebook case a decade ago, which I always, you know, I covered a lot of when we were at Macworld. And
I think the thing there was, I ordered a gavel icon just for you.
Just for me. But I think what was fascinating about that case was, like, the problem is that what came out of that case, which is essentially Apple got it slapped down and made to sort of alter their ebook business. And the result was that Amazon solidified their stranglehold on the market, which in some ways seems like the opposite of the case. But that said, what Apple did to get slapped down was wrong. That's the thing. Like they colluded. They literally colluded, which is why they were, you know, found guilty of that. And their goals may have been, I don't want to say altruistic, not like good, but like their goals may have been, hey, let's disrupt the market to make more competition with Amazon. But the way in which they did it violated
right.
the law. So you can have that. That's a situation that happens, right? Where it's like you have done something wrong and you are going to be punished for it, even if your goals were, you know, to improve the overall state of things. And conversely, you can do bad things that aren't against the law.
Yeah.
That end up with, you know, good or bad results.
And when you say, oh, well, if it's not against the law, then why are they even worried? Why should they need to change anything that they do? And the answer to that is pretty simple, which is, they can do that until the people who make the laws look at them and say, oh, wow, that's really bad. And they make a new law and then they're hosed. Right.
Like
that's the danger. Right. Is that the rules change? Well, I don't see any rule against it. And people are like, oh, well, that's bad. Let's make that like that's why
the
rule
against it. Yeah.
Act happened was because there were trusts that needed to be busted. Yep. And so they passed laws and then the game changed. And if you're Apple, what you don't want to do is get in a position where governments and regulators have no choice, essentially, but to change the rules of engagement away from the rules that have so dramatically benefited you. You always want, and I know I've said this before, but like you always want to be the one who proposes the rules that are going to be used against you, because then they won't be so bad. Like that's that moment where you're like, no, regulate us. It's like, well, as opposed to the, you know, outlawing us. So please regulate us. Just don't break us up. Just regulate us. And it's very much a self-serving kind of thing. I don't know.
No, but
this is a slow-moving car crash here is what this is.
Oh, yeah, sure. And I think you're right that the EU one is potentially riskier for them, if for no other reason than, you know, like in the US, right, where it's like California imposed stricter emissions laws. And as a result, car companies, well, they don't want to have to maintain two different, you know, they don't want to build two different cars, one that passes emission rule in California and one that passes emission rules everybody else, because California is a huge market. In the same way that if Apple gets regulated in the EU, there's questions about, well, how differently do they want to treat what they're doing in the EU from what they're doing in the rest of the world? And then, of course, will other governments, seeing that the EU has decided to pass regulations or something about it, follow suit? And then how much at risk do you want to be for it's like, well, the EU changed these rules. Those other governments might change their rules. Maybe we need to comply everywhere just to be sure. And of course, no better example than the GDPR stuff that we've seen over the past couple of years, right? Where it's like, well, it only affects ostensibly stuff in Europe. But because all these sites are serving up their you know, content to everybody, they're just going to overcorrect and enforce it everywhere, which has its good sides and its downsides.
Yeah. Well, we'll watch as the crash continues, I suppose. But for those, I got a very impassioned email from somebody today saying, you know, basically like explain to me what, you know, what Apple is doing and why it's bad. And it's like, I'm not going to do that. I talked about it a lot. You know, we've gone over it. I think that Tim Cook saying that their policies aren't cast in concrete and that they move with the times is all you need to know about where Apple's head is right now, which is Apple will do, let's be clear, Apple will do the minimum it feels it needs to do. It's not going to offer anything that it doesn't feel it needs to do, but it will continue to do that. And what it considers the minimum it needs to do may continue to grow as it tries to avoid being forced to do something. So there are lots of things on the table. That's what I wrote about at Macworld this week. From an airport, I did a quick thing about podcasts. You are listening to this podcast, so that's a good sign. But Apple Podcasts is kind of broken because they pushed out their new version of the podcast app with the software updates, and it uses the model that all other podcast apps already used, basically, which is that instead of contacting a server directly to see if the RSS feed has been updated, it contacts Apple, and Apple has a crawler that goes out and checks all the RSS feeds. But the crawler is slow/doesn't work, and so I keep getting questions about why the new episode of Upgrade isn't showing up in Apple Podcasts, and the answer is it's in literally every other player. I don't know why, and then a day later it shows up.
Technology.
Yeah.
Grant.
Well, it feels to me I'm just speculating here, as I was in that article that I wrote. I'm just speculating, but it feels to me like maybe Apple had a revenue-generating initiative that they put a stake in the ground about when they were going to announce it. And so they have been shipping, you know, that they shipped this product before it was really ready.
Ready to go, yeah.
Because they had other things going on. Because I can't really explain why they shipped this product when they're still transitioning to their new back end for podcasters, and their crawler clearly doesn't work. And their crawler was already bad. It was always bad. It was always super slow. But it used to be people would say, I looked on Apple Podcasts and that episode you just posted about isn't there, right? Which is, you know, sometimes there's a lag. But what I found was that a lot of people weren't subscribed to the podcast. They were looking at the preview. And the way it used to work in Apple Podcasts is the preview was from Apple's crawler. But once you subscribe, your app looked at the current version of the feed. And so I would say, just subscribe. Are you subscribed? If you subscribe, you'll see it. And they would subscribe and they'd go, oh, that's it. Well, now that bad one is the one that the app sees, and it's not great. So we'll see. I have heard through the grapevine that they're aware of it and will fix it. I have no comment from Apple about it at this time. So that's just the way it is. So if you're frustrated that podcasts that people say are out are not out, I would recommend trying a different app for a while if you're using Apple Podcasts, because that part doesn't work. Doesn't work.
Oh well.
I don't know what else is going on. We're in a little lull here because we've got that new hardware that's been announced but hasn't shipped yet and won't for a few weeks.
And we are, as of today, a month away from WWDC.
Boy, yeah.
Woof! A month.
Yeah. Ugh,
speedy. Where does the time go?
Yeah. So a lot going on in the background.
There is a lot. Yeah.
And yet right now we're in a little bit of a sag point where it's just not, we're between things. We're between events right now. But we know that they're coming. We know that those new pieces of hardware are shipping. We know WWDC is coming. But right now, you know, we're waiting. You can play with your AirTags or whatever, I guess.
I can. I do have some.
I have them, and I have not written anything about them. And I'm not, honestly, same. Dan, I don't know what to say about them.
I haven't lost anything that I put in. Like, yeah, this is the situation. So I bought four, and I immediately, my wife took one and put it on her keychain, which is great because she loses her keys sometimes. And I've sort of jammed one in my wallet right now, which I don't tend to carry with me unless I'm leaving the house. And it did occur to me that one feature I would like, and maybe this is a thing that I'll do, is some other features that AirTags could potentially do. I would like a feature where if I walk out of my house and I don't have my wallet, my AirTag or my phone buzzes or something and is like, hey, did you want to take your wallet with you? Because I think that would be great. Or your keys, right? It would be nice if you walked out the door and it was like, hey, you forgot your keys. And in theory, with the U1 chip and some of the other stuff, you could potentially do that. I don't know. So I think there's some interesting abilities with that potentially around. I was talking to Matt Casinelli, was on Clockwise this week, and he mentioned being interested from like a smart home sort of proximity sensor like perspective. What could you do with that to automate stuff, like knowing that you were in different rooms or near different items or something like that? It's like, interesting ideas. So I think there's a... Yeah, right now, as it stands, I would say that there is not a lot in there that is, like, you know, stuff that's going to break a lot of ground, given that we knew basically how this was going to work, like, 2 years ago. And then there's some refinement that Apple needs to do. There were some, you know, a couple articles about still the remaining possibilities of, say, stalking or tracking people with the AirTags and ways that Apple may need to refine what it's already put in place, just to make that even harder or work better.
Yeah.
So,
I appreciate it. There is a level of pearl clutching to those articles about AirTag stalking that doesn't work for me. I feel like there's a lot of it that's just like, oh, but what about, it's like, it's clearly a product that they put a lot of consideration into ways it could be misused and have tried very hard to make it not do that. And yet the articles still are going to be written and they're still going to be like, oh, sure, Apple's doing this. But the fact is, sure, there are going to be things that are going to get pointed out. And my understanding is that there are changes Apple can make even on the back end that are not, don't require any software updates. So I hope they will listen to that. I think the bottom line is that their response to Android phones is not good enough. Like, I think that's that struck me as being the big one, is this is a case where, because of the stalking problem, you can't get cute about withholding features from Android. I would say they should, they need to just embrace the fact that AirTags essentially need to work with Android to a certain level in order to protect people who use Android phones from being stalked by an iPhone user with an AirTag.
Yeah, and I think the other risk then there, and again, this is, as I think I said on Clockwise, you can only go so far, right? Like, there, you cannot, technology fundamentally and technological devices always have their downsides, and it's always going to be a matter of risk. And you do what you can, and you do as much as you can, but you also, you know, can't discount the utility of these products either.
Right. And one of the arguments is, oh, this is the genie out of the bottle. And like, I get it, but you know, what else, what isn't?
He was already out of
the bottle. This is the most, like because of Apple's coverage, this is a more powerful tracking tool than the other tracking tools that were out there. Like, Tile doesn't have the user base that Apple does, not even close. So, like, this is more precise kind of thing. But at the same time, I think that it's good that Apple is very clearly aware that there are issues and they're trying to engineer them out of the product. At the same time, like, we live in an era where we have smart tracking things and we have devices, our own devices are tracked, and like, there are arguments that seem to be, let's just not do it, and I'm not sure that that is just even possible.
I don't think it's got to be literally a genie out of the bottle argument.
So let's do it ethically and let's try. And so people who want to criticize Apple for having some holes in its strategy that need to be patched, I think are doing the right thing. Some of the things that I've read are very much like, oh, what is this world coming to? I can't believe they did. And it's like, well, this world's already there. It isn't coming to it. It's already here. It's like the people who think that vaccine injections are going to allow Bill Gates to track you with 5G when, in fact, you have a smartphone in your pocket. Like, you already done. Also, have you tried to inject a microchip with a syringe? It doesn't fit. Sorry. You need the alien technology for that. Oh, but perhaps I've said too much.
Nope, we get taken off the air for that.
Yeah, Area 51. 51, 5G, coincidence?
Oh!
Yes.
Yes, yep, 100%. 100% a coincidence.
AirTags, like you said, I haven't lost anything yet. I have a hard time writing about it. I thought about, like, just dropping an AirTag or having my son drop an AirTag somewhere on his way to school and then for me to, like, try to find it or something. But I don't know. They're not that interesting a product. They're fine for what they are.
It's an accessory. Sure.
I think the accessories to them, accessories are kind of ridiculous. But if people want to spend a lot of money for a leather keychain or strap or something, like, go ahead. Like, it just, I don't know. The whole thing just leaves me cold. So I'm struggling to figure out how I'm going to write about AirTags or if I'm ever going to do it, but I've got them here and I'm trying them. I'm just not, again, also I can't, like, aggressively lose something, so short of literally just telling my son to drop the AirTag in some bushes somewhere between here and the high school.
I think it's one of those devices where it's the thing you're not really going to think about until you end up using it. And that's great. It's an insurance, right? It's insurance. It's one of those things where it's like, I put the thing in my bag, and you know what? It doesn't come in useful until the day it does, and I find my bag, and that's great.
Well, the other thing is, I don't really use keys anymore, like keychains. I used to carry my keychain around everywhere and all that, but we put a smart lock with a number pad on our front door, so I don't leave the house with keys anymore. And if I have to drive a car, I'll bring a car key, but we also have a hook. See, again, to avoid losing our keys, we have a hook by the door that the keys go on. So I don't really lose the keys. I keep trying to find something that I lose regularly I can't. The things I lose regularly are iPads that already have Find My in them. Yeah. You can already make them beep. My iPhone, my watch can make it beep. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's not... a lot of the stuff that I carry with me on a daily basis has, like, a place where it lives. So every once in a while, it's not in that place, but usually it's in, like, one of two other places. So it doesn't end up being critical for me. Like, my keys are in my pants pocket, like, 99% of my time.
Yeah.
Like, that's about it. Yeah. And there you go. So, well, you know, again, other people have different relationships with losing things. So for some people, this will be much more useful than others. But I agree, it's not something that... I think if this were not a product that we had known about for 2 years, we would not be talking about it this much.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's an interesting little side dish that ended up getting served long after the main meal had come and gone. And yep. I think it's cool. The other thing is just like we talked about the Find My Network when they introduced it. We talked about it when they did the COVID-19 tracking thing, which is based on it. Like, all the interesting things about it are just exhausted now and have been for a long time. So they're fine. They're fine. I just don't know what to say about them because they are, there they are. They seem fine. If you lose stuff, I still struggle to find like even what I would lose that it'll fit on. Right.
And it's tough because like the most exciting things that came out of that Apple event for me were like, oh, AirTags, I'll probably buy those, and the new Apple TV remote. And it's like, these are both fairly small things that I'm not, you know, these are not like in-depth products I'm going to be spending a lot of time with. So we'll see. With the, depending on what happens at WWDC, maybe I'll be in the market for a new iPad, mainly because my wife's iPad, which is, I think, my old Air 2, she's getting increasingly frustrated with using it because it runs out of battery a lot and it's very, very slow for certain things. So possibility of a trade down situation happening there in the not too distant future, assuming there's something. I think mainly it's like assuming there's something that comes out of WWDC that makes me feel like, oh, I really need a new iPad.
Now's the time, right?
I hope so. So we'll see. All right. I'm optimistic, but not. It is a. I was writing a little bit, my piece next week, and we've covered some of the ground on this already, is the is sort of like challenges Apple is dealing with kind of all right now, which include the chip shortage thing, the legal cases and regulation, and then to a certain degree of Apple, when you get as big as Apple, you're kind of your own worst enemy at times, in terms of seeing like this issue we've all talked about with the hardware and the software on the iPad not quite matching the capabilities. And I think it's interesting because now that we've talked about a lot like the similarities between the iPad, now that it's, you know, an M1 processor like all the Macs, and it's like, well, now is the time to put up or shut up, because if your argument is our hardware is every bit as good as a Mac, but the software does not back that up, it's not really clear what you're doing with the iPad at that point. So this is the time to make that argument, I think. And if they don't, I am just very... very curious about, like, you're going to spend a year of just like, yeah, we got this great hardware still. It can do almost everything a Mac can do, like mostly. Mm. But like, that's not a great argument for the continuing nature of that device. So we'll see.
Yep. Well, hopefully more to talk about next week. More excitement. Get out of the lull a little bit. But who knows? Maybe not. Maybe not. We always find something to talk about, though. Anyway, thank you to everybody for listening and, of course, for supporting Six Colors. We appreciate it. We'll see you next week with more. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.